The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi everyone, I'm Jim Poplava and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest on the program today is Jonathan Clements, How to Avoid Sabotaging Your Retirement. And on today's program, before we get to our guest, we're going to revisit a topic we covered last fall on maximizing your Social Security benefits. Recall that last November, there were sweeping changes made to Social Security. However, there is a window of opportunity that still exists for a couple to maximize their benefits who turn 66 by April 29th. And your spouse was age 62 or older by January 1st of this year. The reason is, if you meet these age qualifications, you will still be able to use strategies that enhance your Social Security benefits. But the timeline for doing so expires April 30th, so you must act quickly to take advantage of these benefit strategies before they expire. Unfortunately, individuals eligible to take action are calling Social Security 800 numbers or visiting its 1,230 field offices, but are getting very, very bad advice. A lot of individuals who are eligible for the more beneficial benefits. So we're going to spend some time clarifying these new rules, many of which are still being clarified, and it's really clear that the Social Security employees themselves don't necessarily understand what all of this means.
But you know, John, think about how many bills that have passed, including Obamacare, where the bills get so complex today that it only is years later where they're eventually clarified. And this one was kind of thrown together at the last of the year. And unfortunately, the Obama administration's initiative to do away with file and suspend and file and restrict strategies was a real blow to women and middle-class families. Typically, women receive lower Social Security benefits because they, on average, spend about 13 years out of the workforce having children. Now, if you understand the way Social Security benefits are calculated, they're calculated over your average earnings over a 35-year period. So, let's say you're a woman, you take a year off to have a child. For that year, you get a zero that gets averaged into your wages over 35 years. Well, picture 13 zeros in 35 years, and you can see why women typically earn less Social Security benefits than their husbands. And the file and suspend and file and restrict were sort of put into place in the year 2000 as a means of sort of correcting this inequality. Unfortunately, the last bill that was passed in November did away with that. File and suspend and file and restrict were strategies that were designed to help correct this disadvantage, because here's an interesting fact. Women make up 85% of surviving spouses on Social Security beneficiaries. So the majority of survivors of Social Security are women. And this is what this strategy was designed to correct. Unfortunately, they did away with it.
Okay, so these benefit strategies are still available to couples, and here's what it is, who will turn age 66 by April 30th, and whose spouses are age 62 by January 1st of this year, which of course is already passed there. So perhaps we should explain how these strategies are going to work and how to take advantage of them if a listener qualifies because of age.
Well, the file and suspend strategy came into play with the enactment of, it was called the Senior Citizens Freedom Act of 2000. A number of things that happened with that too, because it used to be prior to the year 2000, if you were working, let's say you worked part-time, you filed for Social Security, between the ages of 62 and 65, if you made so much money, they would start phasing out your Social Security benefits. And then there was another level between age 65 and age 70. After age 70, you could work as much as you want. Well, with the Senior Citizens Freedom Act of 2000, they clarified pretty much all of that. And they basically said, look, you reach full retirement age for boomers, that's about 66. Once you reach age 66, full retirement age, you can go ahead and work, and we're not going to penalize you for any money that you earn. That way, you can basically work and receive your Social Security benefits. They also added the file and suspend strategies. Now, the file and suspend strategy can be used by a married couple to maximize their Social Security benefits, both, number one, during their lifetime, and to provide a larger survivor benefit, which was what this was designed to do. Now, with this strategy, the way this typically works is the higher earning spouse files for Social Security benefits, so his or her spouse can then collect their spousal benefits based on their earnings record, and then immediately suspend their benefits and delay claiming them until they are, let's say, at an older age, age 70. Now, the benefit of the spouse who suspends their benefit is their benefits will then increase by a guaranteed 8% per year until the age of 70. So, in effect, their Social Security benefits will increase by 32% by suspending those benefits.
Okay, what are the advantages of the spouse, and it's usually women in most cases, so what are the advantages to the spouse?
Well, I mean, the advantages are when the main higher-earning spouse, in this case, generally the husband, suspends their benefits, what this allows, John, is their wife to file and claim spousal benefits before the higher-earning spouse claims their benefits. So, even though, assuming they are, let's say, age 62, the spouse's age 62. That's the other caveat that we have to throw in here. So let's say your husband is age 66, and we'll demonstrate this in a case study today. The husband files and suspends, meaning that he files for Social Security, but he says, don't give it to me until whenever he decides to take it, usually age 70, because it'll go up 8% a year. After age 70, they don't give you any more increases. However, assuming the wife is age 62, she could then file for half of her husband's benefits. So the other advantage is that the lower earning spouse now receives a larger surviving benefit upon the death of their spouse. So let's say the maximum benefit today is roughly about $2,600. If you were to file and suspend, allow it to grow at 8% a year, your benefit would grow from $2,600 a month to $3,500 a month. Now, the advantage here is when the husband passes on, the wife, because the wife would lose her benefits, she would have the option of either keeping her own if she was the main breadwinner, or taking that of her husband. So if the husband files and suspends, that benefit is going to be 32% higher, which means as a surviving spouse, the surviving spouse would have a much, much larger Social Security benefit. And this was a major benefit to surviving spouses, mainly women, as I mentioned, who make up 85% of surviving Social Security beneficiaries. Now, there's also another accompanying benefit for lower earning spouses to maximize their own benefits by using something that we call file and restrict.
Perhaps Jim could explain this strategy a little better. Let's give an example, because sometimes it's hard to see this when you're not looking at it on paper, something that would illustrate how this strategy works to maximize benefits.
Let me give you an example here of three scenarios. Let's just make this easy. Jack and Jill, both age 62. Jack's life expectancy would be age 85. Jill's life expectancy would be age 91. Now, we're going to look at three scenarios. One, they take their Social Security benefits at age 62. Or, let's say Jack waits to age 66. They both wait to age 66. Or the file and suspend strategy. So if we take a look at this case, and let's just take a hypothetical here. So Jack's Social Security is roughly about $1,900. If he was to wait to full Social Security age at age 66, it would grow to $2,200. Jill's Social Security would be $800. So if we take a look at over their life expectancy, let's say they both took their benefits at age 62 and they live out their life expectancy. In this case, Jack lives to age 85, Jill lives to age 91. Over both of their lives, they would receive a total accumulated benefit of $1,316,000. if they waited to age 66, because remember, at age 62, you're only going to get about 75% of your Social Security benefits. And one of the biggest mistakes made in Social Security is filing early at age 62 and only getting 75% of your benefit. Now, if they wait to age 66, they would get an additional $231,000 over their lifetime. They would get roughly $1,547,000. Now, on the other hand, if Jack was to wait to file for benefits at age 66, he would suspend them, allowing those benefits to grow at 8% a year to age 70, at which time he would take them. Jill, on the other hand, would take half of her Social Security benefits, half of her husband's. The total benefit over their lifetime would be $1,642,000, roughly $326,000 additional money over their lifetime. So, John, you can see this has the effect of adding almost $10,000 a year of additional benefit by using this file and suspend strategy. So this works very, very well, and it was something that was designed to make up the disadvantages that a woman holds as a result of taking time off to have children, and in many cases, the wife being the lower earning spouse.
Okay, now what about the other benefit that was done away with, which was file and restrict, which really helped women out?
This strategy works in conjunction with the file and suspend strategy. Now, when the husband files and suspends his Social Security benefits, the wife can compare taking her own benefits or one half of her husband's benefit, whichever is larger. And that was the nice thing about it, because, you know, sometimes there wasn't that much of a difference between the spouse's Social Security benefits. So let's assume in this example, going back to Jack and Jill, Jack's benefit at age 66 is $1,800. Jill's benefit is $1,500. Jack files and suspends his Social Security benefit, so which was $1,800 at age 66. Jill files and restricts, so she is eligible to get one half of Jack's Social Security benefits, one half of the $1,800. That's $900 a month. At the same time, what she does is she does something called file and restrict. It says, look, I'm not going to take my benefits right now. I'm going to allow them to grow at 8% a year until I turn age 70, just like my husband. But I'm going to take half of my husband's Social Security benefits, in this case, $900. At the same time that she does this, by taking one half of her husband's benefit, the $900, so Jill gets $900 a month until age 70. Now, at age 70, Jack's benefit grows from $1,800 because he did not receive it. It grew by 8% a year. It would grow to $2,370 a month. Jill's benefit, because she did not take her own benefit, she only took half of her husband's, it would grow from $1,500 to $1,980 a month. So now, at age 70 for both of them, their combined monthly benefit from Social Security is $4,350 a month, basically about $52,000 a year. So it's really a strategy that has worked out well over the years. And in many of these cases, John, it can add up to literally tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars more in benefits. And the sad thing about it, and I've interviewed Social Security on this, is a lot of people file for Social Security at age 62. They're not thinking. They're thinking, gosh, I'll take it now at age 62 because I'll never get it, which is a fear that is unfounded, because there are a number of things they could do to easily correct any deficiencies in Social Security, one of which I think is coming. They will delay the year of which you can take your Social Security benefits. It got pushed back, John, for you and I to age 66. For Gen Xers, it's age 67. And the stuff I'm reading is they'll probably push that to age 69, given the fact that men and women are living much longer today.
You know, you realize there's quite a difference in benefits. I mean, given that the clock is running out, and assuming that both the husband and wife are at least 66/62 by April 30th, and can qualify, I mean, depending on health and earnings, this is a strategy worth exploring, which could actually increase benefits by over $100,000 over a retirement lifetime. And this is all part of what we call the great reneging, because sooner or later, government is going to have to roll back these benefits. It just simply won't be able to pay them. And how this is going to happen is that promises and benefits are going to be reduced now and in the future as government debt and deficits are going to skyrocket. So the Obama administration is floating really here a trial program to reduce payments to doctors for prescriptions in order to force doctors to use generics rather than state-of-the-art drugs. So as we always say here on the program, the most important thing is please have a plan. You need to understand what's happening. You want to be able to maximize your retirement benefits from Social Security to Medicare to taxes, investments, and savings. So given there is a deadline to act by April 30th, what should listeners do if they think they qualify?
Well, the problem is that this change to Social Security was so sweeping that parts of the law, John, are still being clarified. We recently interviewed Yolanda York from the Department of Social Security here, and even she couldn't answer part of the question. She said, you know, part of this is still being clarified. So the Social Security Administration is making great efforts to inform its more than 32,000 employees who staff up its field offices and its 800 numbers. They're doing everything from written guidance and video trainings, and they've been doing this since the end of the year. The problem is they had to issue two emergency messages. In other words, when somebody clarifies something and all of a sudden they go, okay, now we have an answer to that. One example would be the issue that dealt with divorced spouses. And under Social Security, if you are a woman and you are married to your husband, your ex-husband, for 10 years, you are eligible for one half of his Social Security benefits, despite the fact that he gets remarried. Well, the real issue that came up was what happens if your ex-husband gets married, then decides that he's going to do a file and suspend strategy. Well, the way the law works now, if he files and suspends to benefit his current spouse, that leaves the ex-spouse out in the cold. And that was something that was clarified in a recent ruling that basically said, hey, if you're the ex-spouse and you're the wife, your husband gets remarried and he does file and suspend, that does not preclude you for filing for half of his benefits. So they clarified this. But this law, John, is still being clarified. There's still a lot of issues here that have to be sorted out. The other thing is Social Security employees, quite honestly, are not financial planners or retirement planning specialists. So my advice is, really, if you are one of the fortunate that you're going to be 66 by April 30th, and your wife is, let's say, 62, either case, he or she, my advice is to see a qualified financial planner or retirement planning specialist. I mean, this is way too big of a decision that will directly impact your retirement, literally to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, to leave without having some kind of a plan or knowledge of what your choices are and what the impact will be monetarily. So the biggest mistake, as we often say here on the program, in Social Security is people take their benefits too early at age 62, foregoing benefits that could be almost 60% higher if they wait to a later age.
And I know you're going to discuss this issue this week with today's guest, Jonathan Clements, on how not to sabotage your retirement. And one of the issues here that I'm hoping you'll address is getting a better handle on Social Security and pension income, which, by the way, leads us to the next part of the program, this week's case study, where every week on the program we do a case study to illustrate some of the items that have been under discussion. The life studies are real, but we change the names of the people to protect their privacy.
And the case this week, we're going to call them Dave and Sandy Spencer. Dave is age 65. His wife, Sandy, was age 61. Dave was a petroleum engineer at a major oil company. Assets looking pretty good at retirement. Their home in San Ramon, California, worth roughly about $900,000, free and clear. Dave had a deferred compensation program with the company, roughly with a value of $375,000. He had 6,400 shares of the company's stock that was worth close to $600,000. The value of his 401k program was about $1.7 million. He had cash in the bank of about $70,000 and mutual funds roughly about $260,000. So total value of assets were roughly about $3.9 million. Now, expenses of roughly about $7,000 a month, that was $84,000 a year. Travel expenses, they intended to travel. He actually traveled a lot during his working career, but this time it's in retirement for pleasure. Travel expenses were $25,000. And then we estimated and budgeted about $10,000 for medical expenses. So total expenses per year, about $119,000. Now, looking at their Social Security benefits, at age 66, Dave's benefit would be roughly $2,600 a month. Sandy would get one half of that at age 62. Less at age 62, she'd get about 75% of the one half.
You know, Dave and Sandy look actually in pretty good shape if you look at their asset and Social Security combination. So what plan did you employ?
Basically, what we were doing here, John, was trying to maximize benefits. Now, one of the issues that Dave had is he had a deferred compensation program. He could have taken that income out over a 5-year period, lump sum, or a 10-year period. Since what we wanted him to do, he was age 65, is we wanted him to file and suspend his own benefits at age 66 and allow them to accumulate to age 70. And at age 65, when he retired, we would take out a deferred compensation program, which would be roughly about $75,000 a year. Now, the good thing about this, at age 70, his benefits would grow from about $2,600 a month to $3,500 a month. Sandy, at that point, would be age 66, so she would be entitled to one half of Dave's Social Security, which would be roughly almost $1,800. So their total Social Security benefits, Sandy being age 66, she's 61 now, Dave 65 being 70 then, their total Social Security benefits, John, would be almost $64,000 a year, which would go a long way towards covering their major expenses. Now, since we weren't going to get any Social Security benefits, what we wanted to do is draw out the deferred compensation, which would be taxed as ordinary income. That would be about $75,000 a year. The dividend from the 6,400 shares of stock, company stock, that was roughly a little over $27,000. And then what we wanted to do is we converted the stock funds into a municipal bond portfolio, which I'll explain in just a moment, is going to be more important, especially when Sandy turns age 66 and Dave turns age 70. Because at age 70, he would be getting Social Security benefits, Sandy would be getting Social Security benefits, and Dave would have to start withdrawing from his $1.7 million. We estimated that the IRA would be somewhere over $2 million at that time. So at age 70, his retirement income right now at age 65 would be $75,000 a year. Company stock was roughly about $27,000 a year in dividends, $7,800 in tax-free income for $110,000 of income. Now, that's short of the $119,000 because we threw in an additional $10,000 to his annual budget to account for medical. But remember, he had a $1.7 million IRA, which he was not going to touch for 4 years. And also, both Sandy and Dave were not going to be touching their Social Security until Dave turns age 70 and Sandy turned age 66, at which time they would be getting almost $64,000 a year. Now, one of the things that we also did is in the IRA, we basically put about half of the portfolio in corporate bonds and the rest in dividend-paying stocks. And the idea would be is at age 70, we would start to begin converting part of his company stock over into tax-free bonds, because at age 70, Dave turning age 70 and Sandy turning age 66, he would have a tax problem, because at age 70, their combined Social Security would be roughly $64,000. His IRA distributions from his IRA at that time, which would be valued at somewhere over $2 million, would be about $50,000. Company stock, based on dividend increases, would be $35,000. And of course, the muni bond income is $7,800. So he would have an income of over $156,000. So the idea would be gradually, we would reduce his company stock holdings into tax-free bonds, build up a tax-free offset, because at age 70, both of them would move into a higher tax bracket, with the 85% of their $64,000 in Social Security benefits being taxable. The other thing we did is we changed their AB trust to a disclaimer trust because they didn't need to divide the estate in two, given the fact that the exemption currently is about roughly $5.5 million, their estate being $3.9 million, there was no reason to split the estate.
Okay, now what happens at age 70?
At age 70, a couple things. Number one, Dave would have to take mandatory distributions at age 70 and a half from his retirement plan. And each year, that distribution rate would go up because each year you get older, the government wants you to take out more money. Secondly, because he would not take his Social Security at age 66, it was going to grow at 8% a year, so it would go from $2,600 to almost $3,600. And by then, when Dave turned age 70, Sandy would be age 66. She would be entitled to one half of Dave's Social Security, so she would be getting roughly $1,800 a month. So at age 70, the deferred compensation would be paid out. So he would be getting $64,000 from Social Security and $50,000 from IRA distributions, which would pretty much cover their living expenses. The company stock and the municipal bonds would just be surpluses. So they would be actually building and accumulating a major asset. In other words, their assets would continue to grow throughout retirement, which is what we want. Because remember, we're budgeting about $10,000 a year for increased medical expenses, which in the latter part of retirement, that could cost anywhere from $230,000 to $250,000.
So even though they didn't qualify for file and restrict, it still made sense to go ahead and file for file and suspend, right?
Yeah, because he didn't need the Social Security because we were taking money from his deferred comp program, $75,000 a year. And given the fact that Sandy really didn't work throughout her raising children, her only benefit from Social Security would come from her husband. So the fact that Dave was going to file and suspend, that means his benefit of $2,600 would grow by 8% a year, which in turn would give Sandy a higher benefit when she turned age 66, also a higher benefit as a surviving spouse.
All right, so another successful outcome and due largely to the fact that they indeed had a plan. Speaking of having a plan, our guest coming up next, Jonathan Clements, how to avoid sabotaging your retirement. That sounds interesting. I would never think of anybody intending to do that, but I bet people intentionally do that. All coming up next as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
In a perfect world, most Americans would march through life saving diligently, making good investment decisions, ultimately leading to a secure retirement. But we know we're far from that. A lot of times people make the wrong decisions. They don't save enough, or they do things that can sabotage their own retirement plan. Joining us on the program is author and columnist Jonathan Clements. And Jonathan, let's talk about the reality of today's retirement world where many people will end up in retirement with a nest egg that they basically have, not the one they thought they would have. And I could just think of, you know, the events over the last 15 years, two bear markets, 0% interest rates. A lot of people ended up in retirement with less than they wanted.
And I think that's generally the case, Jim. People might have some number in their head for how much they want by the time they retire, but often, you know, they don't reach that number for one simple reason. They end up retiring before they planned. The Employee Benefit Research Institute does this annual retirement confidence survey, and what they found year after year is that people plan to retire at age 65, but in fact, on average, they end up retiring at age 62 or 3 years earlier. You know, given that, you know, most people are going to end up retiring with less than they expected to have, and we know from other sources that people simply don't have the huge nest eggs we'd like them to have by the time they retire. For instance, in that same retirement confidence survey put out by the Employee Benefit Research Institute, they found that those within 10 years of retirement age, half of those folks have $50,000 or less in retirement savings. These folks simply do not have enough money for a comfortable retirement.
You know, another mistake that we often see, you mentioned that people retire earlier instead of 65, they retire at age 62, and they also take their Social Security benefits at age 62, which is only 75% of their full benefit, versus some of the strategies that can allow that benefit to grow by 8% a year to age 70. So it's not just that they retire early, they make the same mistake when it comes to benefits.
You know, one of the things I say to people all the time, Jim, is that the problem with retirees is that they worry about dying young, whereas what they should really worry about is living longer than they ever imagined. And if your concern is living longer than you ever imagined and not outliving your retirement savings, a key strategy is for the main breadwinner in a couple or for a single individual to delay Social Security retirement benefits until at least their full Social Security retirement age of 66 or 67, and preferably through to age 70. And yet, as you indicated, almost half of all people claim benefits at age 62, thus accepting a permanently reduced benefit. And this is one of those times when the experts talk about this all the time. I mean, almost every knowledgeable financial planner that I talk to pushes their clients to try and delay Social Security until 66, preferably to age 70, and yet so many Americans rush to claim their benefits early and end up with a permanently reduced benefit.
You know, another issue that comes up, and this came out with William Bengen's study back in the 90s about the 4% withdrawal rate. You know, when he came out with that, Jonathan, it seemed reasonable given where the stock market was. It was going up double digits a year and where interest rates are. But we know that that rate may be too high.
Yeah, I mean, when Bengen came out with that study in the early 1990s, at the time, it was an eye-opener for people, and they were saying, a 4% withdrawal rate? I couldn't possibly afford to retire at that rate. Now, let's just take a step back and talk about what that 4% withdrawal rate means. It means that in the first year of retirement, you can withdraw $4,000 from your portfolio for every $100,000 you have saved. In subsequent years, you would step up the dollar amount you withdraw from your portfolio with inflation. So if you retire with, say, $500,000, that would be a substantial sum to most people. In your first year of retirement, you would have a total withdrawal, including dividends and interest, of $20,000. A lot of people look at that number and say, it's way too little. And yet, in today's environment where we have low bond yields and rich stock market valuations, even a 4% withdrawal rate has been called into question. And yet we also know that, you know, if you tell people you have to withdraw less than 4%, they simply can't afford to retire. They simply don't have enough money. So most people need to find some strategy that's going to allow them to withdraw more than 4%. One way to get around that is to use your savings to pay for the early retirement years while delaying Social Security so you get that larger monthly check. Another alternative, and a deeply unpopular alternative, is to look into purchasing some sort of income annuity. But the statistics tell us that those plain vanilla immediate fixed annuities, it's the one annuity product that I'm actually a fan of, hardly any of those get bought every year.
You know, that's amazing because at one time, if you looked at corporate life, when people had defined benefit pension plans, essentially, Jonathan, a defined benefit pension plan was a immediate annuity. A company would go to an insurance company and say, here's an employee, here's the amount of money that we've saved for him or her, given their life expectancy, what would you give them in a monthly check? So why do you think they're seldom used? Because they're great forms of steady income. I know Professor Wade Fow at American College has done quite a bit of work on this and found this is very successful when used with dividend-paying stocks.
Yeah, it's one of those great ironies, Jim. You know, people will work for 30 years at a job they hate in order to become vested in a traditional pension plan where they get that check every month for the rest of their life. And yet, people won't actually take their own dollars and buy a comparable stream of income in the form of an immediate fixed annuity when they retire. It's absolutely bizarre. I think it has to do with this great fear that we're going to buy the annuity and then we're going to keel over and die tomorrow. And we will have given this huge sum to the annuity company and got nothing back in return. And yet, when you think about an immediate fixed annuity, what you should think of it as is as in a form of insurance. And we buy insurance all the time and pay money, and you know, we end up making bad bets. I mean, people buy homeowners insurance and, you know, end up getting nothing back for the premiums paid. People buy life insurance and they never collect on the policy because they don't die. Most of the time, we're pretty happy not to get anything back from these policies. With an immediate fixed annuity, it's the same thing. It's risk pooling, but there is a difference. And in this case, you want to collect on it, and the way you collect on it is living as long as possible. And the great fear is that you won't live long enough in order to make it worthwhile.
But, you know, there are a lot of steps that you can do with those kind of annuities where you can get like a 10-year certain. So if something happens to you on the medical side, you would make sure that the estate was paid a certain amount of money. I want to move on to things when it comes to retirement. We all know that when you get ready to retire, you're probably going to be a lot more conservative than, let's say, when you were getting a paycheck during your working career. But a lot of retirees you talk about are still coupon clippers at heart. Explain what you mean by that.
When I talk about coupon clippers, I'm not talking about the grocery store variety. What I'm talking about is in the old days, when you bought a stock or you bought a bond, those stock certificates or bond certificates would come with a series of coupons on them, and you would literally clip them from the bottom, go to the bank, and you would get your dividend or your interest payment. People love getting investment income. They love this idea that, you know, I'm putting my money into this particular instrument and every month or every quarter I'm going to get a regular income. And the reason that people like this is because it goes back to that golden rule that we all heard growing up, which is that, you know, it's okay to spend your income, but you should never, ever touch your capital. You shouldn't touch your principal. And so if you buy these high-yielding investments and you're able to cover your retirement expenses with them, you're able to meet that rule. You're able to keep your principal intact and get your retirement income. The problem is, in today's low-yield world, if you try to cover your retirement expenses by going out and buying high-yield investments that are going to generate enough income to cover your retirement expenses, you're going to end up taking an alarming amount of risk. You're going to find yourself putting a lot of money into high-yielding preferred stocks, into high-yielding junk bonds, into master limited partnerships. And while some investment in these areas is okay, if it's your entire portfolio, what you can find is that you're taking a lot of credit risk. And if there's a downturn in the economy or a downturn in particular sectors or interest rates go sharply higher, you could lose substantial amounts of principal. So this focus on yield can end up distracting people from the risks they're taking, and they can end up making a big mistake.
You know, this is one thing that we're taught this. If you're a financial planner, you're an investment advisor, you're talked about the soundness of a diversified portfolio. But one thing that I've seen, Jonathan, and this relates back to your coupon clippers, that since the financial crisis of 2007 to 2009, investors have gravitated towards one type of investment as a solution. So as interest rates came down, they went all into bond funds. Or, you know, during the hyper period of gold, when it went up to 19, you saw a lot of people put large amounts in the gold market at the peak. Why do you think people do that today? It's almost like they're looking for a simple solution where basically instead of, you know, a diversified portfolio, some bonds, maybe an income annuity, some stocks, they go all in one particular type of investment.
I think this goes to investor psychology, Jim. And in particular, we are most comfortable owning investments that are popular. You know, if your neighbor is buying gold stocks, if your brother-in-law is buying gold stocks, suddenly gold stocks seem like a safe investment and they become a comfortable thing to own. The problem is when something becomes extremely popular, then the odds are it's also overpriced. If everybody's buying it, the odds are that the investment in question is trading at more than its fair value, and you're going to end up suffering because, you know, once something becomes overvalued, eventually the price is paid. Everybody should have a diversified portfolio. And what that means is that in any given year, some part of your portfolio is not going to be doing well. If you have a portfolio where everything is doing well in any particular year, the odds are you aren't well diversified. And if you're not careful, you're going to end up paying a heavy price for the concentrated portfolio that you own.
I want to move on to, you talk about the proper steps to take when preparing a financial plan. And I guess, you know, it's amazing. I think I read the statistic, Jonathan, you probably know more about this than I do, that most or 70% of Americans don't have a retirement plan. And you would think of something as important as that. And I wonder if that had a lot to do with back in the old days, let's say in our parents' days, you know, mom and dad or dad went to work for a company, spent 30 years, he got his Timex watch and he got a pension and Social Security. So between his pension, which was a defined benefit, and Social Security, he pretty much ended up going into retirement with an income close to what he earned during his working career. But why do you think more people don't do planning today when we know that you need to have some kind of plan? And especially as we've seen in the financial crisis, where a lot of people were laid off, they lost their jobs, ended up heading into retirement at a much earlier age than they would have thought of, not by their own choosing.
Well, if you go back over the past 35 years, what we've seen is that Americans have been asked to take on more and more financial responsibility. We've seen the demise of these traditional company pensions. We've seen an increase in the Social Security retirement age. And instead, you know, people have been pushed to save for their own retirement by saving in 401k plans, 403b plans, IRAs, and their regular taxable account. So people have more financial responsibility than ever before. And even as that has happened, the financial world has become more complex. The number of mutual funds available has skyrocketed. The variety of asset classes that people can invest in has soared. In many ways, for the sophisticated investor, this is a wonderful world. There are so many different investment options out there. But for the ordinary investor who doesn't devote their days to this stuff, it's more perplexing than ever. So the need to have a financial plan is greater than ever before, and yet I think people are daunted by the complexity. The good news is, if you want to have a financial plan, today the financial advice business is far friendlier to investors than it was 30 or 40 years ago. You know, we don't have armies of commissioned salesmen, you know, preying on investors today. There are a lot of fee-only financial planners. There are some great online robo-advisors for the do-it-yourselfer. There are some great online tools that allow people to create their own financial plan. So if you're smart and if you're diligent, you can either help yourself or find somebody to help you, and you should be able to do it without threatening your financial future.
You know, the other thing, too, that we have today that we didn't have, let's say, 25, 30 years ago when I got in the industry, there's so many different investment products that are out there today. There's immediate annuities. I mean, just look at the plethora of ETFs today. So it's much easier to invest. But one of the things that I've seen is that, and you see this even with younger people, that, you know, I was taught when I came in the industry, the idea of dollar cost averaging, which is what most people do when they have a 401k plan and they're putting money out of their paycheck every single month. But a lot of people get frightened because of the stock market. Maybe the stock market goes through a 10% correction and they'll go to cash, when the whole idea of dollar cost averaging, that's exactly what you want to happen, is when, you know, the stock market goes down, you're taking money out of your paycheck into your 401k, you are buying more shares that month with that money when the market's down. And really what it counts, Jonathan, by the time you get to retirement, is how many shares you're going to own.
You're absolutely right, Jim. I teach a college course on personal finance, and you know, I was talking to my students about this recently. I was drawing a chart of the market, and I said, you know, you're going to leave college, you're going to be 23, you're going to be regularly investing in the financial markets for the next four decades. Now, what sort of return pattern would you want? Do you want to have the market rising at a steady rate every year? Do you want to see great returns early on and then sort of flatten out? Or would you like to have lousy returns and then see the market, you know, jump in value as approach for retirement? And the kids, you know, like the idea of earning a steady amount, or they like the idea of putting some money in the market and immediately seeing it go up. But if you're saving regularly for retirement, if you're a young person, you should get down on your hands and knees and pray for a spectacular stock market collapse. Because that, if you're regularly saving, if you're regularly dollar cost averaging into the stock market, that will allow you to buy more shares, to allow you to buy shares at cheaper prices, and you'll be in much better shape by the time you reach retirement. For retirees, it's a completely different story. For them, a market collapse would be a terrible thing, which is why they shouldn't be too heavily invested in the stock market. But for people who are young, who are regularly saving for retirement, a lousy stock market is a wonderful thing.
So in an ideal world, when you're planning for retirement, as you mentioned earlier, people need to plan for living longer. That's one of the things that we've seen. I think when Social Security first came out, Jonathan, the average male was expected to live to age 65. Today, men are living to 85, some in their 90s. So people are living longer. I think the statistic was something like 25 years spent in retirement between a husband and wife. So ideally, if you were to start out in life, let's say you were to take those college students that you're teaching and they were to start out their working career in an ideal world, what would you suggest that they do?
One of the things that I encourage my kids to think about as they look at their finances is to take their so-called human capital, their income earning ability, and put it at the center of their financial plan. Because once you start to think about that regular income that you're going to earn over the next 40 years, it could really guide the rest of your financial behavior. And in particular, there are four things that having that regular stream of income over 40 years allows you to do. I mean, first of all, you need to take part of every paycheck and put it aside for retirement. You need to build up a large pile of financial capital for the day when you no longer have your human capital. Second, when you think about your paycheck, you should think about it as being comparable to collecting interest from a bond. Your human capital is like a massive position in bonds, and that frees you up early in your working life to invest heavily in stocks. Once you get close to retirement and the end of the income from your human capital, from that personal bond that you have to start to change your portfolio and build up the bonds within your investment portfolio to compensate for the disappearance of your paycheck. Third, you need to protect your human capital, and that means having the right insurance. You need to have health insurance. You ought to have disability insurance. If you have a family that depends on you financially, you need life insurance. And finally, when you think about your financial life, you should think about how your human capital impacts the debts that you take on. Entirely prudent to take on debt early in your working career because you know you're going to have those 40 years of paychecks in order to repay those debts. So taking on student loans, taking out a mortgage in your 20s, that's fine. But what you want to do is make sure that by the time you retire, those debts are paid off because you're no longer going to have a regular paycheck to service those debts.
You know, the thing that amazes me, and maybe there's some hope here, you're talking about a college course that you teach on finances, because, you know, we have a plethora of universities around this country, from junior colleges to Ivy League schools to state-run schools. We teach people basically how to go out and earn a living, but we don't teach them how to manage their finances as a result of earning a living. And it should be almost incorporated in every single college curriculum that, look, you're going to go out in your working career. If you're college educated, you're more likely to earn more money than somebody that's non-college educated. But how to manage that money when you do, so that you don't get yourself overburdened in debt. You make the right investment choices early on in your career, and you do things like putting money aside. It's amazing. We've done a number of studies, and if you were to start out, let's say you wanted to retire at age 65, and you began your working career at 25, so you're going to work for 40 years, how very little you need to put aside on a monthly basis starting out early to, let's say, have $1 million by the time you get to age 65. It's amazing. The earlier you start, the longer the period that you compound. But a lot of people just don't grasp that concept, or it's not taught.
You're absolutely right. And for the college kids who get out into the work world and do start to save regularly right away, they can make the rest of their lives easier. If you start saving at 22 or 23 when you get out of the workforce, within 10 or 15 years, you can get to the point where, you know, your portfolio is of a substantial size and, you know, you're getting as much help from the financial markets each year as the raw dollars that you're putting away. And with that increasing financial freedom comes less financial stress. It comes the lowering of the amount you pay in financial costs because you no longer can carry a credit card balance. You know, you can move into a lower cost mutual funds that have higher minimum balances. You can avoid those silly overdraft fees because you don't have enough in your checking account. As you build up your wealth, your financial costs go down, your financial stress goes down, and maybe most important, you buy yourself some financial freedom. A lot of people who start work at 22 or 23 will get to their 40s and realize that they want to do something different with their lives, or perhaps they'll be compelled to do something different with their lives. Global competition, technology changes may force them out of the job that they have. If you've done a good job of saving and investing over those first 20 years in the workforce, you will have the financial flexibility to go off and do something else, maybe swap to a career that's less lucrative, but which you personally will find more fulfilling. By starting to save and invest early in your working career, you can make the rest of your life easier.
So, as you've been lecturing about financial planning issues, teaching a college course, if you were to boil it down to a few simple facts or pieces of advice that you would give somebody starting out, or maybe even somebody heading into retirement, Jonathan, what would that be?
The number one attribute that almost every successful person I know who's got a good grasp on their personal finances, the number one attribute that they have is that they are good savers. If you can't manage to delay gratification, if you can't manage to control your spending, your entire life is going to be a struggle. You know, it's the classic millionaire next door. You know, these are the folks who live beneath their means, you know, don't feel compelled to buy the new car every 3 years, don't feel compelled to own the biggest house on the block. They live well beneath their means, they save diligently every month, and those are the folks who reach a state of financial serenity and for whom their money does not make them anxious. So good savings habits, that is the bedrock on which everything else is built.
You know, you bring up an interesting point. Every once in a while, you'll read these stories in the Wall Street Journal. There was one last year I can remember distinctively. This gentleman started out working in a gas station that his brother owned. Later on, he became a janitor at a JCPenney store, but he fell in love with the stock market, learned about it, went to the library, read Value Line, started investing in blue chip stocks. And, you know, at the age of 90-something, when he passed away, he had over a $9 million portfolio. It's just absolutely amazing. Now, here was a guy that started out as a gas station attendant and a janitor at a JCPenney's with $9 million.
I remember that story. It was about a guy in Brattleboro, Vermont called Ronald Reed. And when you read the story, you know, what you need to realize is that there were two keys to his investment success. One, he was frugal, which allowed him to save. And two, he made a long-term commitment to the stock market. You know, frugality is obvious. You need to save. But making that long-term commitment to the stock market, I mean, that takes emotional tenacity. You know, every year, there's another reason not to own stocks. You know, there's another financial crisis. There's another company that gets into financial trouble. There's political turmoil. There's war in the Middle East. Whatever it is, there's a reason to get out of the market. And yet those who stick around and make a long-term commitment to the stock market, you know, over long periods have earned impressive gains. And those impressive gains combined with good savings habits can lead to startling wealth.
Well, I guess maybe the best example of that is a gentleman by the name of Warren Buffett, who has been a long-term investor, built probably the most successful insurance company in history with Berkshire Hathaway, but employ those same things. I mean, Warren drives a used Cadillac and lives in the same house that he grew up 30 years ago and is, what, the second or third richest man in the world?
Give Warren Buffett his credit. He's a little better at picking stocks than you and me.
Yeah, that's true. A lot more investment acumen. But once again, taking that investment acumen aside, it was a long-term commitment to the stock market, understanding what he invested, and just, you know, he's a good businessman more than just anything else. But you hear all these stories, like the gentleman that was a janitor, and it once again demonstrates that, you know, these were people that didn't have extraordinary capabilities, average people that had a long-term commitment, frugal, and were good savers. Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, how could they do so?
My website is jonathanclements.com, and I blog on there fairly regularly. And if people want to learn about how I think about money, they may want to pick up my Jonathan Clements Money Guide 2016. That's my annual updated financial guide. And the easiest place to get it is Amazon.
Well, listen, Jonathan, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. You have yourself a good day, sir.
All right. Thank you.
You know, Jim, what you were discussing here with your guest, with Jonathan Clements, what's really interesting is we have a situation, it's not just in the United States, by the way, it's also existing in Europe, where there is tremendous disaffection with government. They believe that the governments, and we do here, governments are running out of control. that they are consuming incredible amounts of resources, that their politicians are frequently lying to them. Let's just call it what it is. And at the very same time, governments are having to go into a status of reneging on the things they have promised. Now, what's been interesting is this little rollback that we've been talking about in Social Security, which came up at the end of last year. It has barely scratched any surface. Have you noticed that in all of the presidential debates that I've watched so far? People are totally unaware of what just went down. But it's the beginning of what you and I are calling the great reneging.
Unfortunately, John, the next president, when he assumes office, either he or she, is going to be saddled with $20 trillion, which is going to place a lot of restrictions and abilities. I mean, I have to laugh sometimes why the media isn't picking up on free college, free medical care. I mean, where's the money going to come from when 90% of the budget is spoken for? The other 10% is spent running government. So there isn't much wiggle room here, which is why I think you just saw a new proposal to limit what kind of drugs doctors prescribe, incentivizing doctors to use generics instead of state-of-the-art drugs. And John, I think that's just going to be part of the landscape going forward because basically the government's running out of money. Well, speaking of running out, we are running out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.